From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Salman Rushdie has been an international figure for a quarter century now, since the 1981 publication of his acclaimed Midnight's Children. He's been a fixture on bookshelves, on op-ed pages around the world, and on podiums, speaking up essentially for freedom. Rushdie became a household name in 1989 when Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa saying it was the duty of Muslims to kill Rushdie for blasphemy against Islam. But Salman Rushdie is still here, critiquing, mocking, and illuminating the lives and lies of both the West and the Islamic world. His new novel, Shalimar the Clown, is a love song and a rage over the destruction of the paradise of his youth, Kashmir. Rushdie takes on Islam when it forgets to be tolerant, America when its ideals are betrayed by its actions, and most of all, the Muslims and Hindus, governments and guerrillas who destroyed an oasis of tolerance. This hour on Point, Salman Rushdie on Paradise Lost and a World in the Balance. You can join the conversation. Who is Salman Rushdie to you? Poet? Provocateur? Victim? Visionary? What do you learn when Salman Rushdie holds up his mirror to Islam and the West? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Salman Rushdie is the author of more than a dozen books, including Midnight's Children, The Moor's Last Sigh, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, and The Satanic Verses. He joins me now in the studio. Salman Rushdie, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Hello there. Nice to be here.
So here you are, taking us back to a setting of your youth that clearly glows in memory but has become a kind of nightmare in reality. Would you take us back to that childhood relationship that you had with Kashmir? What is it that gives it such luster in your memory?
Well, first of all, it is where my family originally came from. You know, although they moved away in my grandparents' generation, nevertheless, it was always made very clear to us that that's, you know, where our roots were. And we would go back there as children with my parents every summer for a couple of months. You know, so it was a kind of magical space of childhood, you know, and Kashmir has a natural beauty that is hard to exaggerate. Mm-hmm. One of the higher mountain valleys of Kashmir, Ladakh, was the basis for Shangri-La, mm-hmm. you know, in James Hilton's book Lost Horizon. But even the main valley itself, it's incredibly lush. You know, a lot of India is brown and parched. Kashmir is very green. It has little running streams. It has honeybees, flower meadows, fruit orchards. It's very fertile, saffron fields, and all this surrounded by the biggest mountains in the world, you know, the Himalayas. And that creates a spectacular beauty, which, of course, until the recent troubles in Kashmir, was very attractive to Bollywood filmmakers. It seemed like every movie ever made
had to have that backdrop.
Had to have a dream sequence in Kashmir.
Of course, it's almost the doorway to the home of the gods in those mountains behind as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. So it is the kind of dream space for India, you know, and it's a very strange thing. What happens when the collective dream space gets invaded by violence and war? It's very traumatic.
In your new novel, Shalimar the Clown, you describe the village fathers celebrating their tolerance. You describe this is before those troubles became so acute. Hindu and Muslim living side by side, even in the sort of core mystical coupling in your novel, even marrying one family into another. Is that an accurate depiction? Is this Salman Rushdie's, you know, golden glow of childhood memory?
No, because I mean, I've gone on going to Kashmir as a grown-up, so I have an adult relationship with it as well as a child's relationship. And no, I think I'm not exaggerating. I mean, I think that obviously, and the novel suggests that it's not perfect, you know, nothing is ever perfect. There are tensions, there's economic hardship, there's friction between villages and so on, just because we're human beings, that happens to us, you know. But there was an idea in Kashmir of what was called, locally called Kashmiriyat, which translates as Kashmiriness. Mm-hmm. The idea that what united people, that's to say their common Kashmiri heritage, was more powerful and more important than what divided them. You know, as one of the characters says to another, Hindu and Muslim, these are just descriptions, not divisions. And so when the central couple, the young lovers in the story, Shalimar the Clown and his dancer girlfriend, Bunyi, mm-hmm. who in this village of traveling players, fall in love, they are at first, you know, they do this illicitly because they know that, first of all, they're very young. And secondly, you know, he comes from a Muslim background, she from a Hindu background, and they sneak off to, you know, to do naughty things in the woods. But when it's revealed...
Quite steamy, wonderful naughty things.
I think, you know, I've got better at steamy, I have to say. I used to be very shy about it. You know, if you look at my early books, there's very little on-stage steamy. The steaminess tends to happen off-stage.
Yeah, at least an arm and a leg are on stage
exactly. Now I've managed to get it on stage, yeah. But anyway, when they are found out and actually, you know, accused by somebody who means them ill, the thing that happens is that the village, instead of punishing them, actually decides to support them. They say, you know, these are our children. They're nice kids. They love each other. We should not punish them for being in love. You know, and so as a result, the village elders decide to support the union. And that, for me, is a metaphor of that old Kashmir in which there really was a degree of harmony and tolerance. As I say, not perfect, but a much greater degree than in most places of the world.
Really. An old Kashmir that you tie right out to a global stage, this Kashmiriyat, Kashmirness, almost on a global stage, a synonym for humanity in the yes. sense of humanity's best.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are other places in the world which one could think of, like, you know, Bosnia before that exploded, the old Sarajevo, or, you know, Spain in the time of the Arab rule. But there are places where the world, different communities have learned how to get on with each other, you know, and it's, of course, that is the best of ourselves, you know, and it's worth celebrating.
But the fall from grace is bitter and bloody. And before you're finished here, all of that kind of humanity, that Kashmiriyat is entirely vanquished. The partition of India and Pakistan, of course, the kind of line drawn here that began those tensions, and then a downward spiral, the introduction of Islamic fanaticism, of Indian troops with their atrocities, of Pakistani troops and their surrogates and their atrocities. And before you know it, the family that was supporting, the families, the people who were supporting this humanity in just driven as low as they could be. I wonder if you could give us a reading of just how bad it becomes and the questions you as the narrator or the authorial voice are left asking here.
Well, you know, one of the things that's always very difficult for a writer is to describe horror. You know, it's sometimes very, very difficult to look at it in the eye, you know, as somebody says in the book, because it's like in the way that you can't look at the sun, you know, directly.
You do it with questions once the village has been utterly smashed.
Yes. This is where the Indian army decides for various reasons to come and attack this village of traveling players and does so. Who lit that fire? Who burned that orchard? Who shot those brothers who laughed their whole lives long? Who killed the sarpanch, who broke his hands, who broke his arms, who broke his ancient neck? Who shackled those men? Who made those men disappear? Who shot those boys? Who shot those girls? Who smashed that house? Who smashed that house? Who smashed that house? Who killed that youth? Who clubbed that grandmother? Who knifed that aunt? Who broke that old man's nose? Who broke that young girl's heart? Who killed that lover? Who shot his fiancée? Who burned the costumes? Who broke the swords? Who burned the library? Who burned the saffron field? Who slaughtered the animals? Who burned the beehives? Who poisoned the paddies? Who killed the children? Who whipped the parents? Who raped that lazy-eyed woman? Who raped that gray-haired, lazy-eyed woman as she screamed about snake vengeance? Who raped that woman again? Who raped that woman again? Who raped that woman again? Who raped that dead woman? Who raped that dead woman again?
Salman Rushdie reading from the really horrific kind of penultimate moment in his new novel, Shalimar the Clown. Salman Rushdie, help us answer that question of who.
You know, what happened in Kashmir is it's a sad story. And I think I should just preface it by saying, of course, the world is full these days of sad stories. It's full of explosions and catastrophes, you know. And I think the novelist's art has to be to make you care about them. You know, to say, here's another awful thing happening. You know, we're surfeited with that.
But here, it's not just caring. You draw concentric circles of responsibility that touch, really, almost everyone before it's finished.
I mean, at the heart of it, there are ordinary people. You know, there's a clown in love, if you like, you know, and the girl he loves. And around them are, as you say, these concentric circles. The thing that destroyed Kashmir came from outside. It didn't come from inside. You know, at partition, the India and Pakistan began to fight over it. A ceasefire line occurred where Pakistan controlled about the northern third, India controlled the southern two-thirds. Huge amounts of soldiers marched into the valley. I mean, in a population of 500, of only 5 million, there are over 1.5 million Indian and Pakistani soldiers. Yeah, so, I mean, incredible. Colossal militarization. So the first thing that happened was that the Indian army trampled all over the valley, took all the best resources, at one point began to use rape as a kind of tool of subjugation. And then, almost in response to that, there came Pakistani-sponsored Islamic radicalism. Islamic radicalism unknown in Kashmir, you know, until that time. I mean, the kind of Islam in Kashmir was always of a very mystical, Sufistic, peace-loving kind.
And ultimately, gasoline thrown on that fire by the war in Afghanistan and an American involvement.
Yeah, because in fact, now if you look at who a lot of those jihadists are now, in who come across the border, they're not Kashmiri. You know, I mean, they belong to all the different groups that, you know, whether they're Afghans or Chechens or wherever they may come from. So it is another kind of invasion, if you like.
Responsibility rippling out from A Paradise Lost. We're talking with Salman Rushdie. His new novel is Shalimar the Clown. You can join the conversation. What do you learn from Salman Rushdie when he holds up a mirror to Islam, to the West? What epiphanies has Salman Rushdie brought you? And has Kashmir been just a page 7 news blurb in your life? Can you imagine it tied in to your own fears and horrors and maybe responsibility? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Salman Rushdie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with author Salman Rushdie about the tragedy of Kashmir, about our shrunken world, about the meeting in terror of Islam and the West. You can join the conversation. Rushdie calls for an Islamic reformation. Can you see that happening? And what's your question for the great novelist Salman Rushdie? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Salman Rushdie, there's a big mural we want to look at with you. Shalimar the Clown gets us started in Kashmir, but you really write right on out of there. You take us to Los Angeles and World War II Europe, and really the entire globe brought into your conception here, most directly through the character of an American ambassador to India, who you give the name Max Ophuls. John Updike wants to know why this name. We'll ask you. But he has a daughter by this dancer who's married to your Shalimar the Clown, that daughter named of India, which takes the whole story right back to Los Angeles, into the West, into the West's involvement and pretensions in this setting. What are you getting at with this construction?
Well, at its simplest, this is a novel about betrayed love and the way in which power can intervene in a private life and change it forever. You know, I mean, so here we were talking about the clown and his wife, his bride in love. Mm-hmm. She's rather an ambitious girl. She hopes for a bigger stage, so to speak. But of course, her world is very limited, the world of a village traveling folk theater player. And then suddenly one day, she has a moment of opportunity, which is that the troupe is asked to perform in front of the visiting American ambassador, Max, and he desires her. I mean, he is rather a kind of, he's tall, handsome, brilliant,
playboy,
charismatic, Clintonian figure.
Lyndon Johnson, in your construction, had sent out in the late 60s, you have Johnson saying to Dean Rusk in your fictional version, they liked Galbraith, that is John Kenneth Galbraith, so go ahead and send them another liberal professor, but don't have this one go native on us.
Exactly. I squeezed him in between Galbraith and Chester Bowles.
Right.
And he has a little bit of the qualities of each, but a lot of his own. I mean, he is a philanderer and so on. So he seduces her. And she's, in a way, of course, that's a seduction by power. The man of power looks favorably on her, and she thinks this is going to open her world. But in fact, it doesn't open her world. It destroys her world because, of course, he casts her aside. Mm. And meanwhile, Shalimar the clown, not just brokenhearted. I think it's important to say it's not just that. It's also to do with his honor. You know, this is a culture of honor and shame. Mm-hmm. And when a man's For her to leave him for the powerful American is a terrible blow to his honor. He feels emasculated. And really, as a part of the process of regaining his sense of his manhood, drives him down the path of violence until he becomes wrapped up with the jihadists and indeed becomes, you know, is trained as a killer. And then at the end of the story, but at the beginning of the novel,
yes,
gets his revenge on Max.
An assassin in sunny Los Angeles.
Tracking him down in L.A. Yes.
Bringing all that with him. And of course, it all begins on that kind of magical, misty hillside after their first coupling, when he says, "Don't leave me." This is back in the days of Kashmiri Paradise. "Don't leave me or I'll never forgive you. I'll have my revenge. I'll kill you. And if you have any children by another man, I'll kill the children also." And she replies carelessly, "What a romantic you are. You say the sweetest things."
Well, remember that they're children, and they're 15 years old.
Yeah.
And this is a kind of 15-year-old piece of testosterone, what he says, you know. But also, I think for the reader, it's a way for me to hint that there is a depth in him which, if it stirred up the wrong way, could make of him something much, much more violent. When he's young, people say about him he wouldn't hurt a fly. You know, but that
he's a beautiful boy, plays the clown in the traveling troupe.
Yeah, was a great tightrope walker and et cetera, et cetera. But in him, there is this depth. And I think there's something important there because, you know, of course, one of the major themes of this book is how does a young man like that become a terrorist? You know, and
you have him really standing in for emasculated Islam.
Well, but also,
large.
But then the question is, then what is it that makes a man do it? And I think, yes, you could look at oppression, you can look at resentments, you can look at all those external forces, and that's true. They're very important. However, those forces act upon many people and not everyone becomes a terrorist. You know? So then the question is why this person and not the person standing next to him?
And these are not just literary issues, but you're approaching them from that vantage. Yeah. And what do you have to tell us?
Well, I think
us?
The answer, in fact, is an old novelistic answer. The answer is character. The answer is that in a given individual, there is something which, if those historical forces work on that person, will trigger the response we're talking about, whereas in his neighbor, it would not, because that person has a different nature.
And can, I was casually doing it, but then can the singularity of that character be writ large on a religion? Can you say, well, it's in the character of Islam
I think if you look at the phenomenon of the men of violence, it seems to me that they come from two roots, either very strong personalities, very ideologically driven, or very weak personalities, very easily molded. You know, and if you look at some of the recent things like the July 7 bombers in England,
yes,
they would seem to fall into category B.
That is weak, easily molded.
Yes. Whereas if you look at someone like Osama bin Laden, you would probably look at category A, you know, the strong, determined figure.
And ready to act on a really grand scale. You ultimately have the kind of condemnation of Max Ophuls, U.S. ambassador to India, gadabout lover of this Kashmiri dancer woman. He indulges her, she loses herself, he throws her aside, and she lays down her kind of bill of particulars of him. She says to him in rage at the end, "You took beauty and created hideousness, and out of this monstrosity your child was born, this offspring who gets involved later. Look at me, I'm the meaning of your deeds, I'm the meaning of your so-called love, your destructive, selfish, wanton love. Look at me, your love looks just like hatred. I was honest, and you have turned me into your lie. This is not me, this is not me, this is you." Is this the voice of the East pointing at the United States through the pen of Salman Rushdie?
Well, of course, through my pen, because I wrote it. But I think it ought to be said that it's through the character, you know, and that's how that character feels at a moment of terrible devastation in her life, you know. And I'm on all the sides, you know, because as the author, that's what you have to be.
Yes.
I'm actually extremely fond of Max, you know, and I think one of the interesting things about Max is that he is a rogue. He's completely unrepentant. about the things he does, which are often very damaging of other people's lives.
Yes.
And yet everybody forgives him because he's so likable and charming.
Or they do until he's dead. And at the same time, you call him a servant of his adopted country. He's an immigrant to the U.S. of his adopted country's overweening amoral might.
Well, that's the nature of superpowers, isn't it? I mean, once upon a time there were two, now there's one. But certainly any superpower, never more than this one, you know, is in possession of colossal power. And there's never been a country which has been the only great power on Earth until 1989, until the end of the Cold War. So now, yes, there is an excessive might embodied in the United States. And sometimes that does act in ways which are, you know, to do with self-interest rather than to do with morality. You know, and that's how power operates in the world. So, yes, I think overweening amoral might, fair enough.
Let me ask you, in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, when you had not so long before come to Manhattan and mm-hmm. to make it your home, you wrote, and this is very shortly after, October 2nd of 2001, looking here in the Washington Post, you said, it's time to stop making enemies and start making friends, yes, but you said this is in no way to join in the savaging of America by sections of the left. You said, you know, the people saying the problem with Americans is, what America needs to understand is. Here we are in 2005. Are you changing your tune a little bit as America? You were encouraging in 2001, October, the United States to stand up and fight back.
Well, I supported the attack on Afghanistan. I still do. You know, and I think that was a necessary thing. And I think maybe one of the reasons we have not had more spectacular al-Qaeda attacks is because that attack did a great deal, in my view, to lessen the power of al-Qaeda. You know, so I mean, I can see absolutely a justification for doing it. What I think has been very problematic is, first of all, the old Western failing of the lack of follow-through, you know, so that Afghanistan seems increasingly left to its own devices, and what seems always has seemed to me the red herring of Iraq, the diversion of resources from what seemed to be the justifiable search for the leadership of al-Qaeda into this other increasingly messy foreign excursion.
And one that has the American image in trouble.
Well, you know, it is a terrible thing because actually in the aftermath of 9/11, the whole world was deeply sympathetic towards the United States. You know, the French, you know, of all people, ran newspaper headlines saying we are all Americans, you know. And to have gone from that position of universal sympathy to a position of, well, I wouldn't say universal, but very broad worldwide resentment in the space of 3 or 4 years is a negative achievement of some scale.
Pretty amazing trip. We're talking with Salman Rushdie. His new novel is Shalimar the Clown. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And Zaya is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Zaya. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm so excited to be able to speak to Mr. Rushdie. I've been an avid reader of yours since I was 14.
That's good.
I've read everything, and I'm 22 now, so 8 years and all your books. And I wanted to know about, you know, the drawing of the line between Kashmir and L.A., because they're both, you know, fertile, glittering paradises that seem to be crumbling. And what really led you to pull those two places together?
No, well, it's exactly that. I wanted to say here, if you like, are two earthly paradises in terms of natural beauty. And the forces working against them, you know, the forces leading to, as you say, a kind of crumbling, are very different. But I wanted to juxtapose, if you like, two crumbling paradises.
You open the book with Max Ophuls, Rogue, and the daughter of his relationship with the Kashmiri dancer together in that California paradise, crumbling at the edges. Zaya, does that resonate true to you? Zaya, are you there?
It absolutely does. I grew up, you know, with parents who are both from immigrant families. So I understood that the places that they came from were kind of these old world paradises, and then they come here and it seems like a new world paradise, and then for my generation it begins to crumble. So I felt really connected to India when I first started reading.
Oh, good. Well, that's I'm glad. Well, it seems to be working then.
Zaya, thanks very much for your call. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Catherine is calling from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to echo the last reader's comment. It's so nice to speak to you, Mr. Rushdie, and hear you reading your own work. My question was actually not about Child Mother Clown, which I'm just starting to read, but about past characters and sort of the sense of not quite fitting in, not belonging. I just wanted to hear you speak about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came from India to an English boarding school when I was 14 years old. And when I arrived, I had no concept of myself as being foreign. You know, I just thought I was just me. And actually, I knew quite a lot about England before I came to England. And I didn't expect what happened to me, which was that for the first time in my life, I discovered that I was being treated as, you know, as an other. I was very shocked by it, because it's a hard thing to learn about yourself, that you are alienated from other people by not by reason of anything you've done, but just by reason of who you are. And I've always thought that really probably my problem at an English boarding school was that I was bad at games. I think
simple as that.
Yeah, I think if you're foreign and clever, you could get away with it
if
you're good at games. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're foreign, clever, and bad at games, that's the triple whammy. You know,
so was it a curse or a blessing, ultimately? Here, now you're Salman Rushdie.
Well, but what it did is gave me at that very early age a sense of what the caller is talking about, a sense of slight apartness, you know, of not quite belonging. And meanwhile, of course, you know, I'd been taken away from the country I'd grown up in, and I go back there, and I still feel very close to it. But there's a sense in which, you know, I'm not who I would have been if I'd never left. You know? So there's if you like, a double unbelonging, you know. And that can sometimes be, well, obviously it has been helpful in the sense that I've written out of that.
Yes,
you know,
again.
Yeah, but I also, that it can have the opposite feeling. I mean, sometimes I don't feel double unbelonging. What I feel is multiple rooting. You know, I feel not that I'm uprooted from everywhere, but that I'm rooted in too many places.
So if we ask you about your allegiances now, you'll say, what, the roots go down many places,
yeah,
everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself belonging more to cities than to nations, you know. So I mean, I feel like, you know, Bombay feels like my hometown. London feels like home. I feel like a New Yorker now after 7 years. Those things seem to be where I put my roots down, those ideas, the ideas of the city, rather than of the nation.
And Los Angeles, you write about it, you say, to learn the city was to discover this banal clarity was an illusion. That is, the clarity of the L.A. skies. The city was all treachery, all deception, a quick change, a quicksand metropolis hiding its nature, guarded and secret in spite of all its apparent nakedness.
I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time in L.A. the last 6-7 years because my wife is an actress. She had an apartment there. And to tell you the truth, I pinched her apartment for the character in the book because I thought I may as well write about the neighborhood I knew best.
Right, right.
But it's true. I think one of the great differences between New York and Los Angeles is that in New York, everything's out on the sidewalk. You know, in L.A., everything's behind gates. You know, the real life of Los Angeles happens in private, whereas the real life of New York happens in public.
Somewhere in here you quote, and I forget if it was in reference to L.A. or to Kashmir, that what was not hidden, what was overt, was not true.
Well, you see, this, I think, that's at a point where it relates to the way in which people re-educate terrorists in that camp. You know, the idea being that the world that you see is false. You have been lied to about everything. The entire construction of reality, which you believe to be real, is a lie.
This is the fanatic fundamentalist indoctrination message.
Here, instead, is another better description of the world, which you should now make yours, and which, of course, justifies various acts. So there's a point, and this is something not unlike what the Chinese did, you know, during the Cultural Revolution. It was that kind of process of re-education.
And Americans now, are they suspending disbelief?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think some, yeah. But I think, you know, I'm quite encouraged by one aspect of what's happening in America, which is there seems to be a real desire to learn more about these new parts of the world with which America is now deeply engaged, you know. And if you look at the bestseller list, the idea that a novel like The Kite Runner about two boys growing up in Afghanistan, you know, could spend 2 years on the bestseller list, or that a book like Reading Lolita in Tehran, what it shows is that there are people really hungry for information of the kind that books can give.
Maybe we're looking through the veils. My guest this hour is Salman Rushdie. His new book is Shalimar, the Poet. The clown. You can join the conversation. Salman Rushdie calls for an Islamic reformation. Can you see that happening? Do you see Salman Rushdie as a poet, a provocateur, victim, visionary? And this, can Islam in the West share this little planet? Are there too many wounds and grudges and fears? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Salman Rushdie about the tragedy of Kashmir, our shrunken world, and the meeting in terror of Islam in the West. His new novel is Shalimar the Clown. You can join the conversation. What do you learn from Salman Rushdie when he holds up his mirror to Islam and to the West? What epiphanies has he brought you? And can Islam and the West share this little planet? He writes about the trouble that Islam and Hinduism, or at least the cultures around them, had in sharing his beloved Kashmir. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Salman Rushdie, we were talking just before the break about this path to fanaticism, the suspension. Don't believe what you see. Believe what the bigger picture that we, the fundamentalist truth tellers, give you. You write to that in the book at one point.
Yes, this is a moment where Shalimar the Clown is actually being instructed by a radical mullah called Bulbul Fakh. And this is what the mullah says. "The infidel believes in the immutability of the soul," said Bulbul Fakh. "But we believe that all living things can be transformed in the service of the truth. The infidel says that a man's character will decide his fate. We say that a man's fate will forge his character anew. The infidel holds that the picture of the world he draws is a picture we must all recognize. We say that his picture means nothing to us, for we live in a different world. The infidel speaks of universal truth. We know that the universe is an illusion, and the truth lies beyond that illusion where the infidel cannot see. The infidel believes the world is his, but we shall drive him from his redoubts and cast him into darkness and live in paradise and rejoice as he plunges into the fire." Shalimar the Clown rose to his feet and tore off his garments. "Take me," he cried. "Truth, I am ready for you."
All right. Salman Rushdie reading from Shalimar the Clown and really describing there the path to what? This is a song that must be sung in many ears every day now. We see all the suicide bombers who are ready to step up. We see, we're told even by the CIA, the number of volunteers for the conflict in Iraq growing.
Well, you know, it was, I mean, obviously it's a subject I've thought about a lot. It is one of the things that I wanted to try and show, the inner reality, you know, of this process, because I think it's something the novel can do. You know, the novel can allow readers, if it's properly done and if you care about the people concerned, the novel can allow you to leap into a reality which may be very alien to you, like the reality of a terrorist or whatever, you know. And I mean, you were saying earlier about, you know, Islam and the West and so on, but I think it's also important to say that there's a terrible battle inside Islam. And indeed, what happened in Kashmir, as we were saying, is that a very gentle, tolerant, harmonious version of Islam, the Kashmiri version, was attacked from outside by radical Islam.
Yes.
So there's, and you see that phenomenon of an attack on moderation by radicals across the Muslim world. I mean, that's what the Taliban did to the Afghans. You know, that's what the Ayatollahs did to the Iranians. So it's not only a battle between Islam and the West, it's also a battle inside the Muslim world.
And we have callers who want to speak to exactly that. Julie's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Julie, you're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Rushdie, I want to thank you, first of all, for being a voice of moderation and reason in this whole discussion. And my question is, why do you think there has not been a more forceful and articulate outcry on the part of intellectuals and artists in the Muslim community against this corruption and co-option of their religion. I mean, I remember several years ago there was a full-page ad in the New York Times taken out by prominent Jewish intellectuals and artists criticizing Israel, and that just seems to be something that is called for at this point. You
yes.
know, stand up and say, this is not right, this is not what our religion is meant to be, and it can't keep going like this. Why do you think that has not happened?
Well, I agree with you that it's desirable. Just to offer the case for the defense, I think a number of people of liberal, moderate persuasion in the Muslim world say that the media don't want to listen to them and that always go to the more radical voices or conservative voices. I'm not sure to what extent that's true, but it is said in defense. I think it is, you're right, it's a lack. Why are there not those full-page ads, as you say? And I've been arguing that it's time that the very large, which I believe to be a large silent majority of moderate, integrated, secularized, ordinary citizen Muslims in this country or in Britain or whatever, it's time that they made their voices heard over, not just over the radicals and the terrorists, but also over the institutions that exist ostensibly to represent Muslim opinion, which are often, mosque-based, very, very conservative, very, very orthodox and old-fashioned in their social views. And I know, for example, in England, after the July 7 bombings, there were a lot of Muslim voices speaking up and saying, we don't feel represented by the so-called leaders. But there is a problem of a lack of really representative institutions. And, one can only point to it. I really hope that such institutions begin to emerge.
So are you saying those moderate voices should arise just among American Muslims and British Muslims? Or is there a hope of that moderate voice arising from the heart of the Islamic world? Or is that... is that moment gone?
Well, it may be that this thing has to start in the diaspora just because the level of repression. I mean, many Muslim majority countries are very authoritarian countries, and the opportunities for free speech and for social and intellectual rebellion are very small.
But you're even critical of the voices who seem to kind of take responsibility after the London bombings. Sir Iqbal Sakrani, if I've got the pronunciation right, saying, you said for the first time in your memory, saying, admitted, these are our own children, speaking of the Muslim community. And yet you point out, he was one of those who was very critical of you when you were under the fatwa, a man who said of you, death is perhaps too easy, that is, for Salman Rushdie. It should be worse than death.
Sakrani is not a particularly nice man, and I think he falls into that old camp of people that in which category I also place such major intellectuals as Cat Stevens.
But you say the traditional leadership, orthodoxy, not even that hidebound in orthodoxy, is incapable of the Islamic Reformation you're asking for.
Because
so where on earth does it come from?
Because these are very conservative men. They're almost all men.
Yeah.
And their attitudes are not modernizing. Their attitudes are backward-looking and conservative. So there are many modernizing voices, but they are not organized. And I think one of the things that needs to happen, I can only point to the need. I can't make it happen.
But is there a chance? Yes. You see the world. Is this an utterly... is this just never going to happen?
Well, it better happen, because if it doesn't happen, then there will be a moment at which this idea of the clash of civilizations, which I actually distrust as an idea, will come to seem true.
Think we're not in it already?
Because as I was saying, there is such a clash and an argument inside the Muslim world.
Right.
And the West is not monolithic either. In this country, there's a great debate about whether this country's administration is doing the right thing.
The president's ambassador at large, Karen Hughes, is out right now. We see her on the television screen smiling and shaking hands around the world to try and head off this clash of civilizations. Yeah. Effective?
But I think just as the West is divided, so is the Muslim world divided. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the important thing. However, if the argument about the future in the Muslim world does not become much more vocal, and if the modernizing impulse doesn't arise, then it's very easy for people outside that world to believe that the silent majority tacitly accepts the radical point of view, because at the moment all the momentum is with the radicals.
How do you see your own voice in this conversation? When Salman Rushdie calls for an Islamic reformation, does that drive Muslims toward a reformation or away from it?
Well, it depends which, I think the conservatives are never going to like anything I say because it's me saying it, But I think that, it was interesting when I published those articles that the response, certainly in England, and those articles were mainly aimed at the situation in England after the July bombings, the response was, I would have said very positive on the whole, that, you know, many people of Muslim background wrote in agreeing and offering their own ideas, you know. So, I mean, I think this is the role of an intellectual in a society. All you can do is point at the problem and try and suggest some ways forward. In the end, the rest of it is up to the society. I mean, the change in the Muslim world will have to come from inside Islam. And I've always believed that the defeat of the war on terror, let's say, I think will in the end be won because from inside the Muslim world, you know, when Muslims decide they won't allow that stuff to happen.
And what's anymore. The change on the, let's say, American side that would most likely help nurture that within the Islamic side?
Well, I think, you know, less bullying, more dialogue. You know, I mean, I think this has been an unusually an administration unusually unwilling to deal with other countries, you know, on any basis other than simply doing whatever it wants.
But you, Mr. Manhattanite, put your dukes up right alongside George Bush right after 9/11.
At 9/11, as I say, I agreed with the. I mean, what should you do? You knock a bomb arrives and knocks down planes arrive and knock down, you know, a big chunk of your city. It's not a moment to say, you know, we're going to come at you with flowers.
And now?
I thought the Iraq thing was and is a mess. And I worry that what is happening in Iraq is the training of a whole generation of jihadists, you know, which we may see the consequences of for, you know, 15, 20 years to come. So I don't know. You know, I mean, I think the problem in Iraq is that whatever you think about the war, whether you were for it or against it, we now have a situation which is a mess and which can't be left as a mess. So, you know, we have to wait. We have to hope that some kind of some kind of workable society comes out of it.
Julie, thanks for your call. Faisal is calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Faisal, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I must first thank Mr. Rushdie because he had such a tremendous influence in my literary upbringing, going all the way back to Midnight's Children. You know, I still remember passages from there, the monkeys at the temples, and, you know, that was just fantastic. The comment I have is really related to this question of not belonging, which I think is a theme that occurs consistently in Mr. Rushdie's writing.
Yes, it does. Sure.
Certainly, Imaginary Homeland deals with it, and I you know read that essay, you know, with a lot of intrigue and related to it in many respects.
So, what do you make of it?
Well, I actually now don't entirely endorse that view, and I'll tell you why. I get the feeling that writers like yourself, certainly post-colonial Indian writers. Part of my heritage as well, have made an incredible contribution to the discipline, and certainly, I mean, you have in some ways led that movement. I do think that when it comes to younger South Asians like myself, who have grown up in South Asia, in the UK, in the US, in Europe, we say this on behalf of myself, my siblings, my friends.
Take us to your bottom line, Faisal. What is it?
We don't feel the kind of angst that Mr. Rushdie describes of belonging. We almost don't need that kind of belonging anymore. I think of myself as being in a very privileged location of not having to deal with the kinds of issues that you did, and I acknowledge them, and I acknowledge them as being very difficult.
You're seeing a generational shift, a generation move beyond the need for that old-fashioned belonging?
I do. I don't define the word rootedness in the same way that you would. I think of myself as a piece of seaweed that landed in Marblehead and could easily move from Marblehead to, you know, the Arabian Sea.
Salman Rushdie, does that rock your world?
No, I think it's very well said. Actually, I do think there's a sense in which it is a generational shift. That's to say, you know, each generation deals with the stuff it has to deal with. You know, my generation grew up in the aftermath of the violent partition of India.
The end of colonialism, boundary drawing and destruction.
Yes. And then in my case, of course, I mean, I'm a first generation migrant, so I had to deal with the business of coming from one place and accommodating myself to another, you know, and of course, young men and women born and brought up in the West and not having had to face those issues will feel differently.
But I mean, does a more global citizen, maybe it's Faisal, mean a less conflicted, angst-filled, conflict-oriented citizen or not?
I don't know how angst-filled I am. But actually, one of the things I've actually been writing about for a long time is exactly this idea of a different idea of roots. You know, and actually way back in my novel Shame in 1983, yeah. I pointed out that roots are a kind of conservative myth, one of the characters says, designed to keep us in our place.
Yes.
If you look under your shoes, there's nothing growing out of it into the ground. One of my other books, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, was really about this, exactly what the what the caller describes, the phenomenon of people who don't need the idea of home so much, you know, who are more easily able to move across the world. And yes, it is a kind of privilege, and one has to say it's a privilege which a few people share and many people don't.
And yet you show hatred flowing right through those same kind of global conduits. I want to get one more call. Faisal, thanks for yours. Bruce is calling from Newbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, it's an honor, and I'll make this as quick as I have a question. I was wondering if Mr. Rushdie would be willing to comment on the possibility, and just as a preface, I say this as someone who's getting ready to launch with a group of experts on the American religious right, a national initiative to combat the American religious right.
Bruce, go straight to it. Our time is short. The question.
Okay, so I was wondering if Mr. Rushdie would be willing to comment on the possibility of a mirroring phenomenon between the rise of extremist elements in American in Christianity, especially American Christianity, and extremist elements in Islam.
Let us pick it up, Salman Rushdie.
Well, I think I can't prophesy because this has to arise from inside the community. But I think the kind of initiative you talk about, in which people come together to combat the activities of the more conservative aspects of their faith, is very, very important. And I mean, I really hope that some such echoing movement does arise,
Just in Islam, but.
But, you know, in any religion, I mean, I think it's you need to not allow the radicals to have the ground to themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be able to say there is another voice.
Bruce, thanks for your call. We've just got a minute left. You open the book with a quote, Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet, a plague on both their houses. Who? What plague?
Well, I mean, you can read that quote two ways. You can either say, as I first thought of it, that it's about the way in which India and Pakistan between them destroyed the paradise of Kashmir. And the Kashmiris have always wanted both sides to back away and leave them to themselves. So it came out of that originally. But I think there's a sense in which it also connects to this sense of the West and the East, the mutual incomprehension of the two, leading to each damaging the other in different ways. And, you know, I mean, I think anybody like me, a writer with an essentially tragic view of the current world, feels much as Mercutio felt at that time.
Oh, and Updike's question, I almost forgot it. Why Max Ophüls is the name of the German film director from years ago? You've co-opted it. We've got half a minute.
You know, I wasn't going to call him Max, but I thought I was going to call him a name like that, a kind of Franco-German name, and the name just got stuck to the character. I wanted to change it. Every time I tried to change it, the character didn't like it. So it's his fault, not mine.
Salman Rushdie, his latest novel is Shalimar the Clown. Salman Rushdie, thanks so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for being back with On Point.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.